ain't a thing if it ain't got that swing. Don't mean a thing, all you've got to do is swing. Makes no difference if it's sweet or hot. Just keep that rhythm, everything you've got. Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Nobody else ever made jazz before we did. Jazz is American music. Jazz is a way of playing music even more than it is a composed music. Almost any music can become jazz if it's played with jazz treatment. The best jazz is often played without music, from a tune remembered, and played as one feels like playing it for fun at that particular moment. So said Harlem Renaissance poet Langston Hughes. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. What is jazz? Where did it come from, and how do we define a musical category which, by its very emphasis on freedom and improvisation, seems to defy definition? Is there any difference between jazz and swing? Joining me to explore just what is jazz, anyway, is John Schaefer, professor of music theory and jazz at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and a jazz bass player. Welcome to University of the Year.
Pleasure to be here.
It almost seems like there's irony involved in trying to define jazz.
Well, certainly there is. If you go back through the 120 years of the art form, you can see there's dozens of definitions, and nobody can quite get to the crux of what it is. There's what I call the ism definitions. It says it has some of this or some of that, but that's a piecemeal approach. I think in my own interest in jazz as a bass player, the need to do what I call swing is critical to making music. And I started really thinking back in my ideas of music theory exploration and other kinds of music. I'm always looking for some larger overriding sense of what makes something what it is. And I've heard all these 120 years of jazz, and I was convinced there was something in there that allowed us to listen to every single one of those examples and say that's jazz, even if we don't know what it is. And hopefully by the time we're done, I'll give you some clues of what I think it is when we're talking about it.
Well, I'm sure we're going to be listening to a lot of examples.
We will.
Maybe you
we
could
will.
Set up one. Let's hear an example and talk about what for you would make that jazz.
All right. Well, let's go back. Let's do this historically. So let's go back to a very early example. This is from the original Dixieland band, would have early recordings. So they would have been playing in the first two decades of the 1900s, but this would have been recorded a little bit later. But this is what we call Dixieland jazz. The things you listen for is that there's no hero in this band. So you don't have a soloist. You don't have a person who's in charge, who's the head. The whole band is playing as co-equals, and it's very much what we consider as this early Dixieland style. It's also based on the blues. And so we get coming from the 18th century, and the blues and indigenous African music was a very popular form. Everybody knew how to play it. They knew how to sing it. So it became the basis. So anyways, this is a tune called The Lively Stable Blues by the original Dixieland Jazz Band.
So as we're listening to this, tell me what you hear in that that sort of jumps out and says jazz to you.
Well, first of all, it swings. And we won't get to that definition yet of what I mean by it swings. But I think if you feel it, you have an inherent drive to want to tap your foot. There's just something that sort of propels the music forward. An analogy I always like to use is called the tripping down the steps analogy. You're walking carefully and all of a sudden you lose your footing and you start to go a little faster than what you think you should be going down, but that's an exhilarating moment when you're rushing ahead of those things. So it certainly has that. It has a lot of, we often talk about improvisation in jazz. So all the way, very early jazz, we get the interplay. These people are not all improvising against a given song. They're listening to what each other's playing. Mm-hmm. and they're improvising against what each other's playing.
And I assume that they're playing without music?
They're playing without music. Yes, yeah. Absolutely without music. So they know the basis of the tune. So in some real simple definitions of jazz, we talk about the notion of improvising against something. And the something in those early tunes was the form of the tune, which would have been the basis of the blues. Later on, we get melodic improvisation. We'll take a known melody and utilize that melody and improvise against it. As we get later into the future, we'll see that they stop doing that because everybody knows the tune, so you don't even have to know the tune, or you don't have to play the tune and improvise. You're just improvising. Everybody knows what you're doing with it. Other things that come here that start to mark very early jazz and carried on through is what we call the bending and twisting of the notes. You could hear the way the trombonist would dig down and he'd swoop, and you'd get this strange sound effects. And so it was not like a classical musician who was keenly intent on having the right sound for the right note. This use of what we call blues notes, stretch notes, expended notes, flutter tongues, all were part of the early jazz. What I think makes this interesting, of course, is that the people who were doing this were actually usually fairly trained musicians. If you go back to Creole culture in the late 1800s, at the post-slave years, there were lots of sort of messing around between slave owners and their slaves. And so we get this sort of mixed race people, but they were certainly interested in educating these people. And many of the ex-slaves' children would actually go over to Europe and study traditional classical music. So they had some of that trained art form. So one of the things you also hear in the early jazz and all the way through is a level of musicianship that tends to transcend much higher than you would get if you just simply had somebody who was a self-taught guitarist or just singing, something like that. So all of those feed into this.
And would you know, I opened with a quote by Langston Hughes where he says, nobody else ever made jazz before we did. Jazz is American music.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that because of the bringing over of the African rhythms and blues notes, minor notes, whatever you want to call different things that came over at that point and mixed with the European influence and instruments, that you get something uniquely American? Would
absolutely,
you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think if you look today in academia, virtually every music school in the country has jazz programs. It's been accepted into the sense of being a true art form that's a purely American art form because it is that melding and that coming together. And it's also culturally related to being in New Orleans. So the Creole culture was very important in that and blended all of those like no other place in the country. So the first 20 years of jazz were sitting in New Orleans before they start coming up the river, so to speak.
Is it a danger to make jazz acceptable and mainstream? Does that kill the revolutionary spirit of it?
You know, that's a big question. As we'll hear some later examples, what you'll hear will sound nothing like the Dixieland jazz. But the essence is once we get a better sense of what it means to be jazz, I think it just evolves. And jazz is constantly changing, just like every art form. We can't look at Bach and then listen to Wagner, and we wouldn't hear much of the same thing at all within them, but we still call them artworks.
Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah. So you mentioned that the one we just heard has no soloist, has no kind of standout.
Right.
What about when you get to someone like Fats Waller?
Well, then you get to Fats Waller. So pretty soon as we start through, the biggest figure of the time became Louis Armstrong, probably the most prominent early jazz player of all. And Louis started to really work and develop the idea of a high level of musicianship and also started to focus on the work of one musician. So by the time we get into Fats Waller, we're just starting – the music starting to move its way north, moving towards Chicago, which ultimately becomes the first big explosive place between Kansas City and Chicago, the blues. And you start to begin to see this idea of the really good musician becomes a focal point. So while you hear some of the same things, the rhythm section on this next example, it's called Dinah, starts to recede a little bit into the background, so it plays a little more of a supporting role, and you get a singer actually in this one, and then when soloists come out, they do it individually. So this would be a good time perhaps to hear this one, tune called Dinah, probably about 10 years later than the example we just heard.
Dinah, is anyone finer in the state of Carolina? If there is, then you know her. Sure to me, Dinah, with those Dixie eyes blazing, how I long to sit and gaze in to the eyes of Dinah D. Every night, why do I shake with pride? Because my dynamite changed her mind about me. Oh, Dinah, should she wanted to China, I would hop an ocean liner just to be with Dinah. Swinging on out to Jackson. Yes, yes. Yes, yes, yes. Bye, 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 bye.
So tell us what we heard there in
terms of the instrumental. Well, I should ask you what you heard in there.
Well, I heard a lot of the playing around between the singer and the instrumentalist, sure, going back and forth and sure, kind of riffing off each other.
Yeah, well, the riffing is an important thing. It really comes back from the old blues version, what we call a call and response. So in a typical blues song, it's always sent with, has a short, say, a four-measure passage where the person plays for the first two measures and then somebody responds. And that came back from the slave days, and this idea of somebody singing a line, inventing it, and then have the other people respond to it. When we heard the first example, you had that collective responding, everybody doing it together at the same time. Now it's becoming much more truer to the traditional call and response. The singer was singing the line as a soloist, and then the trumpet came in the background and played, and every one of those was an unrehearsed little line that was reflecting on what the singer was doing. It's almost as if he was waiting, the trumpet player was waiting for the space between the words, and as soon as there was a space, throw in a little line like that. It still had a lot of swing, still beat, but again, you could hear the rhythm section was now playing more of a supportive role, and the soloist was coming on top of this and doing a lot of coloration of the melody and things.
And would you say when you're using swing, are you talking pretty much about syncopation?
Well, swing is a term that's been bantered around forever, mm-hmm, right from the very earliest jazz. And we come back to the isms. There's syncopation, which can mean you play ahead of the beat, you play behind the beat, you feel like you're pushing the beat. There's syncopation in terms of you play a soft note and then you play a loud note. And when you play loud, it's on an offbeat. So that's certainly part of it. But a lot of it is then you listen to the singer and the singer waits before they come in. So they're behind the beat a little bit. If you listen to the bass drummer and the bass player, they're kind of pushing almost as if on the front edge of that beat. So all of this collectively works towards the notion of swing. I think it's a little deeper than that, but that's, mm-hmm, that's what I do. And it's a thing that makes your foot want to tap.
Yeah.
And when you hear it, the music, even if you don't like it, you can't help but move to it. And I would say that's a universal that goes all the way through history. So.
Would you say that the history of jazz also goes along with the movements, the dance, and things that the environment? I mean, we talk about the jazz age. You have a certain atmosphere that sometimes surrounds it. You don't picture jazz often in a sort of concert hall where everybody's being quiet the way they would in a symphony.
Yeah, now you do.
Now you do.
Now you do.
But
as it's moved, but because there's not the club. That's a very interesting point. Because the original Dixieland, it was basically in drinking establishments and bars for, mm-hmm, which dancing was not part of it. And you get into the 20s and the roaring 20s and a sort of dance culture, and people had a little more money, was after the war. They're looking for entertainment where they could dance. And so it was logical that the same players who were playing in the bars would start playing in the dance halls, which actually leads us to the very next major breakthrough, which is in the 30s. And we get the big bands, the swing bands. Some people would argue they're not really jazz because they're really dance bands. They were big because they had to fill a dance hall and put 300 or 400 people in there who were making a lot of noise. So it was less improvisational but still maintained much of the essence of the syncopation of jazz. One of the things that's just an aside before we listen to the next tune is this notion of jazz may swing, but jazz is also a language, and it's a complex language. And the language morphs over time. It's like reading Old English and Modern English. Sometimes hardly a word matches, yet they're the same language and came through, mm-hmm, the same origins. The same thing happens with jazz. So again, it was my quest to say, if we read 400-year-old German and modern German, what is the essence that still sits in there that makes us realize we're still reading German? That may not be the question everybody wants to ask, but that's an important question.
But
to
you're
me.
Trying to figure out what are these elements of jazz,
that's right,
that remain the same over time,
yeah,
that are constants, universals.
That's right. And things like syncopation changes over time. Things like improvisation comes and go. Things like soloist versus multiple improvisation comes and goes. The various ways in which you change the beat comes and goes. But I would argue that underlying all of this is that concept of swing. And we'll keep refining that notion as we go through.
There's also in the two excerpts you've played so far a sort of wildness, you know, an energy. Yeah. There's a character in a Toni Morrison novel called Jazz who says, just listening to this music makes me feel like I've broken the law.
Okay.
And there's a kind of almost out of control, danger, edgy energy that you feel. It goes along with wanting to move, but there's something in the music itself that's very powerful and you feel it.
It is. And I think if you go back, I'm not a sociologist, so I don't know all of this, but if you go back and look at the impoverished industrial age when jazz was coming through and the people who are still suffering from racial prejudice and other things, that you would work your 16-hour day or 18-hour day and you needed to let loose and you wanted drink and you wanted something that would completely pull you out of the doldrums. And I think jazz fulfilled that.
Well, also, if you are writing if you are an African-American musical performer at a time where things are so tremendously unjust, mm-hmm. if you go against the mainstream in your music, if you are kind of going against the beat and against what's expected, that is a kind of revolutionary art form then.
Yeah, and that may explain some later things. But if you go back and look at the early, like the first example, this was a culture where the blacks and the whites and the blondes all interacted together. So this wasn't there wasn't quite the need there for the black musician to be fighting against the norms of the white because they sort of all shared the same norms. They were rural people, plantation people and things. And so this really got – it was a much more integrated culture. It wasn't until we start to move north in the 20s and the 30s that you start to get these bifurcations of different ways of thinking about the black music as opposed to the white music, as opposed to the blues-based Kansas City, as opposed to the soloist-based version of Chicago, and it starts to all break up. But so you talked about dance. Let's listen to this third example. This is from Duke Ellington called Coco. I really enjoy this one. We're now to the point where it's for dancing, so the form has to be a little more regular, predictable. It's trying to meet a large audience, so it has to be a little more generic and general in its sense and can't be just flagrantly made for the drinking crowd or whatever you want to say on it. Much more overtly composed. So and arranged, so this is the age of the great arrangers and great band leaders who really have people on their staff who do nothing but arrange music and known tunes and new tunes for this large 17-18 piece ensemble. So let's listen to a little Coco.
Would most of that have been written down?
Almost all of it would have been written down. So this is the age in the 30s of the big band. These you require very well-trained musicians because they're no longer playing by ear and they have to read these musical charts. And they're fairly complicated charts. And as you can hear, there's a lot of different interaction, rhythmic things going down. They still had soloists in there, but the solos were a minor part. I think anybody who's grown up in a culture listening to rock and roll songs knows that the song is pretty fixed and then you get 10 seconds of a guitar solo in the middle of it, and then it goes back to the fixed song. So this is much more within that culture. So the dancing, you wanted the beat, you wanted the rhythm, you wanted those pulses of all the brass instruments and the saxophone instruments to help you drive you into the dance. And getting quiet and having the rhythm section play underneath the soloist does away with the feel to want to dance.
I think Duke Ellington is the one that said that he would like to have Louis Armstrong on every instrument.
Oh, yes.
You know, to kind of cultivate that approach.
Well, this was also – these were becoming very prominent people and the best musicians were getting the gig. So we're now elevating the jazz musician to the level of many classical music players. That these were some superstars. Louis Armstrong, by the time you get to the mid-30s, had pretty much defined what jazz was. And as the best-known trumpet player pretty much in the world within the medium, and for his entire life was respected. And virtually anybody who studies jazz has to go back and spend a lot of time looking at Louis Armstrong's music. He was a very refined musician, but he understood and embedded lots of these guttural influences that we see in jazz. If anything, when you listen to Louis Armstrong, you start to hear somebody who's taken the essence of the lowbrow and the guttural and turned it into the essence of almost a concert level of listening. So he's incorporating all those little ideas in there, but he's refining them. If you, in listening to this last example, for example, things that would not be written but that they would rehearse and understand is when all of those trumpets were coming in and they were just an eighth of an inch in front of the beat every single time they played. And so you had to also study and understand the art form. But to get five trumpets to play exactly the same required a high level of musicianship.
We're going to look at more in the quest to understand the definition of jazz when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with John Schaefer, and we are talking about what is jazz. We were just listening to some Duke Ellington, and you were talking about the big band era, the 1930s and so on, with World War II on the horizon. Yeah. How does jazz start to change?
Well, jazz didn't change much until the war began, and one of the biggest changes is it was hard for bands to tour with 18 players, all men at that time, when there was a war effort and a need to recruit. So you suddenly have a demand for much smaller ensembles. So five people can't fill a dance hall the way 18 people can fill a dance hall. But several seminal things happened at that point besides the fewer number of players. The U.S. government imposed, I believe it was in 1942 or the end of 41, what was called a cabaret tax. And this was a tax to support the war effort and basically said that any institution that considered itself a cabaret, as in they had dancing or served food, would be taxed 20% of their gross profits. This tax went all through the war, and actually it wasn't until about 1962 or 1963 that they finally eliminated the tax. So almost overnight, any dance hall that had a big band and had people dancing was verboten unless you wanted to pay a lot of money and increase your fees 20-30%. So the combination of fewer musicians and way, way fewer places to play jazz created a new model that if you were one of the few jazz players who was still around, you wanted a job because there were now very fewer places. So you better be a lot better than everybody else. So we sort of see the birth of what we call a bebop, which suddenly became purely instrumental jazz that was now designed to be listened to because dancing and eating were not allowed. So we're back into the bars and we're back into purely listening environments. And we have two figures by the name of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie who came along and became virtuosic and developed a new style that had so many notes that almost nobody could play it. By doing that, they sort of guaranteed their supremacy on the stage and thus was born bebop. Now, we don't have a lot of recordings from the bebop era because there was also a recording band and the musicians were saying we're getting nothing. So through most of the war years, nothing was being recorded. This particular piece I want to play by pianist Bud Powell was recorded in 1946, but it would have been from a slightly earlier time and is representative of that era. Things that you will hear are virtuosic level of playing, lots and lots and lots of notes, an elevation of the rhythm section as a smaller group to becoming a little more equal in here. Why don't we go ahead and listen to a little of Indiana. Thank you.
that has that wild falling down the stairs kind of feeling,
too. It sure does. It's still swinging. It's still this rushing. You can hear the bass players just working like crazy. And if you've ever played on upright bass, that takes a lot of energy to do that. These musicians would get on the stage and do this for 3-4 hours at a time and just playing away. Lots and lots of notes, very clearly aimed at somebody who had to and wanted to listen to this music. It wasn't just your popular radio kind of thing. It was also fairly seminal in a couple other ways, in that we talk about modern jazz and early jazz, and this is really exactly at the point we go into what most people think of as modern jazz. It's this idea of jazz moving away from an entertainment to something that's being a seriously listened to kind of music. You're no longer dancing to it. You're no longer sitting there drinking in a bar and ignoring it. You're now there, and you have to put out an effort to do it. And it's very important. It also changes sort of the style of what you improvise again. This is not a blues. By the time we get into the 30s and into the 40s, the blues starts to disappear as the framework against which we do the jazz. This tune, Indiana, there's a lot of tunes by Gershwin, one called I Got Rhythm, which became – wasn't so much that the melody was important. It was the series of chords or the chord changes that became a structural basis. And everybody who played knew these. And they knew how these chords worked, and they played melodies. They wrote their own melodies on top of them. But everybody going would recognize Indiana instantly as Indiana. To this day, if I go out on a bandstand somewhere with people I haven't played, and they say, let's do Indiana, or let's do, blow some rhythm changes from I Got Rhythm, it doesn't mean we're playing either one of those tunes, but I know exactly what I'm supposed to play on the bass, mm-hmm. and we'll make that work. So we really get to the era now, the virtuosity. Osos are moving away from sticking too closely to the melody, too closely to something. It becomes the ability of the improviser and the musical things they make almost more important than the tune. So we're quickly gone from the tune, and it's just a shadow.
Another name that comes up always when you talk about jazz is Miles Davis. How does he fit into the story?
Well, Miles Davis was a young trumpet player during this time, younger than either Charlie Parker or Dizzy Gillespie. He got his start playing on the bandstand with these gentlemen in the early 40s. My own personal opinion is, while he was good, he wasn't up to the level of those guys. But he also was a smart businessman, and Miles had a different style of playing. One of the things that Miles sort of did is almost a counter-revolution, as he said, bebop is killing jazz because there's very few people who can play bebop, and there's an awful lot of people who, guess what, they want the older, softer, easier to listen to jazz, so they're not really engaging in this at all, and we're starting to lose audiences. By the time you get to the mid to late 40s, the blues had come swinging back in, and blues and country music, blues became dominant. If you look at rock and roll in the 50s, virtually every single rock and roll tune written was based on the blues. And Miles said, we're going to kill jazz unless we do something different. Now, he wasn't tuned into the blues, but he started with the saxophonist Jerry Mulligan, what was often referred to as West Coast style or cool jazz. There's a beautiful album he came out with. It was actually recorded in 1949, but the record company didn't put it out until 1955 because they thought it was too forward-looking. But it was a counter-reaction to everything that was bebop, and it was his idea that he was going to create sort of something very different and try to restore the jazz world back to coming to jazz before they all went away to the blues. Let's listen to this tune. It's one of my favorite off of this what's called Birth of the Cool recording that, again, was recorded 6 years before it came out. But this is a tune called Boplicity. It's only about 3 minutes. If we could listen to the whole thing, I think you might enjoy it. And you'll hear the difference almost instantly. Thank you.
When Miles Davis put this together, was he mostly thinking about those who would purchase the recording, or was he – what kind of audience expectations did he have?
Well, if you hear this tune, when they would do it live, the few times they did it, it was much longer. We're also now with the record industry's booming, but 3 minutes and 20-some seconds is about what you'd get on a record. This was 3 minutes and 1 second long. So certainly the sales of records were becoming huge, and somebody like Miles would get paid and go on concert tours in support of the albums. He would make a lot of money off of the albums, but it was mostly doing the concert tours associated with the recordings. So yeah, it was his – he changed over the years, and we can look at the 10 different styles of Miles Davis. And so it's never quite clear what Miles was actually thinking. And so we speculate on some of these things. But clearly you can hear there's a wildly different set of expectations coming out of this. We see a maturing. So obviously lots of space. Everything slows down. The soloists are playing a tenth as many notes. There's open spaces where you go for a couple seconds and you don't hear anything except just the rhythm section going here. It's a softer, softer attack. You don't hear the hard pulsing. It still swings. They're still doing the thing that makes it swing, but it's a radically different sense. Even a sense of sloppiness in some of the playing comes in there. Now, if you listened carefully, there's actually a new instrumentation. There were 9 different players in there, and they had French horn and other things. So moving towards this notion of orchestration and trying to make a more complicated art form out of it was also part of what was going on here.
And if you keep going forward, looking at how jazz is changing, what do you come to next?
Well, what we get is another bifurcation. So Miles didn't stick with this style very long. He quickly went back to other things. People like Jerry Mulligan and others went to the West Coast, and it became very popular on the West Coast, started infusing Latin music into the styles. And so it keeps going. It's just somebody comes and adds something new to the pile. So what we get now is the counter-revolution to the counter-revolution. And you get people like Art Blakey who come in and said, no, you know, this cool jazz stuff is sort of okay. We like our bebop, but we notice that people want the blues, something a little more familiar. So let's start to infuse blues back into. Let's infuse some gospel. Let's put a little R&B into this thing, but we can still play hard and a little rocking like a bebop or just calm it down a little bit. So here's a very famous tune. This next one is called Moanin', done by the Art Blakey Group. And Art Blakey was probably most notable for that style. So this is what we often refer to as post-bop or hard bop because it's wanting to go back to bebop but changing the style. So let's listen to the little is moaning. We only need to listen to the first part of the tune.
In that one, you really hear that sort of call and response with the piano and the instruments back and forth.
Every way back to 1900, 1910s, mm-hmm. the call and response, the blues, the more guttural and simple music. But it's certainly still, you swing, you still want to tap your foot to this thing and move it. So there's a whole bunch of that. One of the most, the biggest characteristics when listening to this is that you no longer have a bass player walking four to the beat. It's now down to sort of a shuffle beat. Rather than boom, 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 boom. And so a lot of little characteristic differences. We also see there's a period when pianists start to become more and more important. Famous pianist that came out of Miles Davis's group, as Miles Davis went on after his cool jazz thing, was a pianist by the name of Herbie Hancock. And he went in a completely different direction. So this is probably the fourth or fifth bifurcation of where we go. And I think this will speak for itself. So if we could play Chameleon, yeah.
I was just thinking how different that sounds from the Dixieland band that we started with.
Oh, yes,
sounding
absolutely.
Very different now.
Yeah.
Tell me what you hear.
But I would argue that everybody still calls this jazz.
Right.
In fact, one of the things I talked earlier about is that every single one of these recordings so far have come off the Smithsonian collection of classic jazz. So at least the Smithsonian Institute thinks that these are all forms of jazz. This would be a good example of a player who played jazz but was saying that rock and roll is coming to life. That's been in the 60s, early 70s, and that we're losing the battle of being a popular art form. And so maybe it's time we start using electric instruments, start getting into the funk, get rid of the idea of complicated chord changes, and let's get back to that age of dancing. If you think in the 80s, we move into the disco era and everybody's back to wanting to dance on the dance floor. So there was a whole faction of jazz players that went off in this direction, including Miles Davis with his electric band and played electronic trumpet and everything else. So we get the 70s and early 80s with this sort of jazz almost disappearing, as many people would call it, jazz.
And if you had to list the elements of jazz that have been in all the recordings so far, would you say improvisation, sort of syncopated or different rhythm, playing off each other? What are some of the things that all of these have had so far?
Every one of them would have syncopation at some level. Mm-hmm. And syncopation is a very broad definition of what it means to syncopate. Virtually everyone has some form of improvisatory function that goes beyond the 10-second guitar solo kind of improvisation. They all swing, and maybe it's time before you take another break to sort of introduce this concept of just what I'm thinking about in swing. If you go back and listen to every single example we've heard so far, the rhythm, the beat, the pulse is absolute. You could set the nuclear clock by it, and it never changes. It's always there. Yet we don't listen to this music and think of it as being so metronomic. What we in fact hear is the factions of syncopation, the way players play, is they're playing against that constant pulse. And that's the dynamic that I would argue creates swing. Everybody knows what the beat is. Everybody knows what the pulse is. And it's always there, but nobody's playing it. They're all playing against it, but only playing against it with that realization that it sits there. So when I talk about swing and you hear a bass player jumping the beat, or you hear the drummer playing, or you hear the sax players hitting syncopation, or the singer coming in late, every one of those is an example of how the different players are playing against the beat. I'll share a quick little story. I have a jazz ensemble at the university that I coach. And when we start every fall, every time I get the drummer, these kids have never played with each other, they all start slowing down. And I said, they're slowing down because you must be listening to the piano player. And he says, yeah, why is that a problem? I said, well, piano players tend to play behind the beat. And so if you're the drummer and you're hearing the piano player, you're going to start slowing down. Bass players want to play in front of the beat. So first listen to the bass player. Lock that in. So you got that sense in your body. Then go listen to the piano player and enjoy how that behind the beat of the piano player melds with in front of the beat with the bass player. And the whole thing suddenly makes you want to snap. It's a kind of a built-in tension. It's inherent give and take. It's like rubber bands pulling against this constant beat. And if you just started playing like a computer and stuck to the beat, it wouldn't sound like jazz at all.
More on jazz when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with John Schaefer. We are talking about the definition of jazz. We were just talking about swing, okay. And you were arguing that all these pieces of music that we've been listening to, that what makes them jazz is that they swing.
Yeah.
Can you give an example of what a piece of music sounds like with and without swing?
Well, I can. I've got a couple examples I'd like to play for you. Because it's not often that you get pieces that have that crossover. One of my favorite pianists, jazz pianist, 60s, 70s, 80s, Bill Evans, and he's a very well-trained musician, and he was also a composer. He wrote a piece of music that he recorded in the mid-70s called Since We Met. And it starts out with about 30 seconds of a beautiful freeform introduction. And as he starts to get ready to do the song, you can all of a sudden feel him just start to snap into that pulse. And you can feel the difference between his free introduction and what it gets to when he's ready to go and he pulls in the swing. So if we could hear like 45 or 50 seconds of Bill Evans' Since We Met. Anyways, I hope you can hear in there where that transition came, and certainly for the rest of the piece as we listened to it. You have this very clear, strong sense of pulse that's in there, although Bill is never really playing the downbeats. He's not playing that pulse at all. He's playing against it and working it. Well, I like this particular piece. There's a French pianist by the name of Jean-Yves Thibodeau who created an album. It's called The Conversations with Bill Evans. And Jean is not a jazz player at all, but he loves Bill Evans. What he did is transcribed literally note for note 8 different Bill Evans solos and then plays them in his own classical music, French impressionistic style. I want you to hear about a minute or so of the same piece. It's literally the same notes pulled out of that solo, but this time played by a classical musician. Thank you.
That sounded like Debussy.
It does, yes. It really did. A specialist in French Impressionist music.
I'm guessing you would say that does not swing.
It does not swing. The music is beautiful. I love the notes. It shows how well-trained Bill Evans is and there's beautiful things. But one of the things that it doesn't swing is because, in fact, introduces all kinds of rubato, which is what a classical musician does. Rarely will a classical musician keep the pulse on a solo piece. They speed up, they slow down, they pause, they breathe. And these are all of the things that are sort of non-existent in jazz, or if they are, they have to do it against that pulse that never stops. And so here you can hear that you would never mistake the second one for a jazz tune. If you didn't hear Bill Evans first and know that this was about, you'd probably think, oh, I never heard of that Debussy piece before. So,
one thing we haven't talked about is ragtime. Where does that fit into the story of jazz?
Well, a lot of people think that ragtime was the forerunner to jazz, and ragtime in the 1880s, 1890s was the popular form, most likely found itself in published piano, solo piano renditions. It certainly has some syncopation and other things, but I'm not sure it had the swing to it. I think that ragtime introduced these musicians to the idea of playing a pulse and working with syncopation. It also was not an improvisatory form. It was a written-out form. But I also have two final examples maybe we can listen here of the same tune called the Maple Leaf Rag, and I think most people know that tune.
By Scott Joplin.
Yeah, the first example is played by Dick Hyman, who is actually a very well-known jazz pianist. He's in his 90s and still out there playing. But he plays it in a way that's fairly close to how somebody would have played it in the 1890s. So maybe let's listen to just a minute of Dick Hyman playing Maple Leaf Rag.
He's playing
it fast. And it certainly, you get your foot tapping, but it just doesn't pull me forward. Mm-hmm. Like I said, so you can hear some of the essence in there. Now, just about 10 years later from when that would have been played that way, here's Sidney Bechet, one of the early performers in Dixieland style, playing the same thing with his band. And I think you'll instantly begin to hear what the swing does to this version of it.
So this is Maple Leaf Rag.
This is Maple Leaf Rag again.
But with swing.
With swing.
Those two examples are really clear.
Really clear. You could hear the horns pushing the beat. Everybody's just driving this thing, and the wild improvisation of sounds. Yeah. Thank you.
This has been an amazing history of jazz through all these different excerpts, and it really makes you think about what makes it jazz. My guest has been John Schaefer, and I want to have us go out on this University of the Air program on something that you would call modern jazz. Can you set something up, and then we can go out listening to it?
Sure. I'll try to do this quickly, but, so we talked about in the 60s and 70s, we get all these different bifurcations of jazz, everybody going different. But there's sort of the core. What happened in the 60s became sort of established as mainstream jazz, and in the 80s and 90s, all the way till today, we sort of come back to that, what we would have said the Miles Davis type and things. So the fringes went their own ways, and we get a standard jazz. But what's happened is that the concert or bar scene disappears, and being able to go hear live jazz gets harder and harder. Jazz has become an academic art form. Now, virtually every university offers degrees in jazz, and the players are coming through, are studying and learning to jazz and learning to compose at a level it was never dreamed of back in the 30s and 40s by these players. So we get kind of an amalgamation of taking a standard jazz style, adding the complexity of big band arranged charts, adding the kind of complex rhythms that nobody could sight read if they were to just go sit in on a jazz session. They become almost major compositions unto themselves. The level of virtuosic playing is through the roof. There's a pianist, good pianist, is actually from Wisconsin, Jeff Keezer. He lives out in California now. But here's his version of Stompin' at the Savoy, probably recorded about 10 or 12 years ago, but I think it's very indicative of sort of the complexity and compositional way we're going with modern jazz.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air.